He was a key member of the Boston Celtics dynasty in the 1950s and 60s, the 1957 Rookie of the Year, a six-time NBA All-Star, part of eight championship teams as a player, two more as a head coach, one of a select few to be inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame as both a player and a coach, and for more than 30 years has been one of the team's television broadcasters. I'm pleased to welcome in a true Celtic for life, Tommy Heinsohn. And Tom, before Boston, you were starring for Holy Cross, a school that was both during your time there and before your time there, well noted for its basketball program. Of course, times have changed, and the NCAA appearances for the school are few and far between. So it must be gratifying, satisfying as an alum, to see the basketball team whenever they get back to the NCAAs, and especially last year getting that tournament win in the opening round game.
Well, the whole basketball world changed quite a while ago. And the school, which has always been a small school, currently right now there's only 2,500 students, and more than half of them are women. So in my day, they were all boys. So they didn't elect to go into the Big East, and because of that, the level of competition slowed down, and they're in the Patriot League now, which last year they ended up being able to go to the tournament, but they're not one of the top 10 teams anymore like they used to be.
You helped lead the Crusaders to the NIT championship in 1954 when the NIT was a major tournament. You became the school's all-time leading scorer before being a territorial draft pick of the nearby Boston Celtics in 1956, part of a draft class that also included a guy by the name of Bill Russell. I read that Red Auerbach, the legendary head coach, wasn't sure you'd make the roster, and so you considered playing amateur basketball for a National Industrial League in Illinois before Bob Cousy, another Holy Cross product, intervened. How did Cousy convince you to stay and keep trying to make the Celtics roster?
Well, I wanted to play in the NBA, and I just thought that some of the things that Red Auerbach said about me at the time, to me it appeared that they weren't interested. So when I got the phone call from Cousy, he said, "Don't listen to all that stuff that's in the newspapers. They really want you. You got to go down and talk to them right now." So before I even could make a move to really think about going to play for the Industrial League team, I was in a car and on my way to Boston.
And you certainly proved Auerbach wrong, or certainly made him turn his thoughts around with a fantastic first season that ended with you being the Rookie of the Year. In the NBA Finals that year, the Celtics against the St. Louis Hawks, you scored 37 points and had 23 rebounds in a double overtime Game 7 victory. I have to imagine that game stands out for you among many, coming in your rookie season and also considering the circumstances.
Well, that was the Celtics' first championship, and it was a big deal. And to this day, I still think it was the greatest game in the NBA because there's never been a double overtime in the finals, let alone the seventh game. So it was a big deal.
Did you get a sense after that first championship that this team was a dynasty in the making? Maybe not as many championships as it turned out to be, but that this could go on for a while?
Well, St. Louis was a very, very talented team, and the next year we lost to St. Louis. Bill Russell got hurt and missed like four games, and so they won it. But after that, we took over. And that next year, the year that we lost to St. Louis, we all believed that we really had a great basketball team and could go far. I mean, we ended up in that era of having eight of the Celtic players on the roster ending up in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, as you said, so many wonderful players many of whom are in the Hall of Fame, have their numbers retired, and you're among them, from Cousy to Russell, Bill Sharman, Sam Jones, I'm just naming a few there. How did Auerbach manage to maintain a team concept where all the egos, I guess, so to speak, were in check during those championship years?
Well, the basketball team, the leadership of the team, really was Bob Cousy, who would score, but the fun of him playing was really to pile up the assists and help other people score. And then Bill Russell came along, and his forte was defense. So it wasn't who scored the most points. It was who really had the biggest impact on that team. And we never did have a top 10, you know, a guy that was in the top 10 scorers or ever won the scoring championship. So it's always been put together like a basketball team, even to this day.
This has been, ladies and gentlemen, one of the most fabulous series of basketball games and game that you will ever have the pleasure of viewing. Cousy, the expertise with the dribble, and he's showing it all right now. And he goes against the entire Laker club as they double and triple team, and the ball game is over. The final score in overtime. Red Auerbach, Boston Celtics are the world champions, 110-107. Bill Russell and Auerbach exchanging bear hugs at midcourt.
Certainly one of the biggest rivals for the Celtics, if not the biggest, was the Los Angeles Lakers. But in your case, your team prevailed in each finals meeting. The Lakers, of course, a fantastic team in its own right with Jerry West and Elgin Baylor. What gave the Celtics the edge each and every year facing the Lakers?
Well, Elgin Baylor, to this day, I think is right up there with the very, very, very best that ever played the game. And certainly Jerry West is the same. We were fortunate enough to have more Hall of Fame players than they did. And we have Bill Russell, who really revolutionized the game on defense. So most teams, when they played the Celtics, not only had to play the best defense they ever could play, but they also had to develop a singular different offense than they normally would use, because Russell made them change what they normally would like to do, just his mere presence.
Mm-hmm. After 8 championships, including one in each of your final 7 seasons, you retired as a player in 1965. And then in 1969, you were hired to become the head coach of the Celtics, succeeding Bill Russell, who had retired and was a player coach. How much pressure did you feel knowing that you had no prior coaching experience?
Well, this may sound strange, but when I was a player, I really was sort of like an assistant coach, in that when a rookie would come along and Red would ask me, what do I think this kid needs to work on? And, well, go work with him on it, you know? So I knew that part of it. And Red always solicited advice, even like the last 2 minutes of a ball game, from all his players. So playing for the Celtics, you had to become a very thinking basketball player. Otherwise, you wouldn't play. In dire times, were asked to come up with something that would help you win the game, and you were expected to tell everybody, your teammates in Red, what you thought would work, and then you'd have to go out and do it. So that was players that played for the Celtics really were more thinking players than people imagine. But I also, before I became the coach, had 4 years at the management end of life insurance business. So I was recruiting, training, and supervising and motivating people into a business. And when I took some management courses when I first started that part of my life, I found out just how good Red was as a manager of people. And when I got the job, I emulated it.
Yeah, were there any particular tactics from Red that you specifically used early on and maybe throughout your coaching career?
Well, I believed in a philosophy. What Red would do is really make the other team go through a physical torture test. He'd try and overpower you. We had, at times, a pressure defense, what they would call a press, which made you think on offense twice as fast as perhaps you normally would. But we had a fast break team that really attacked on every possession. So we worked on beating their stamina by just running up the court with speed, not just trotting up the floor, but accelerating the pace of the game. So if you took the marathon and you were going to run against the world's greatest marathoner, you'd probably lose. But if you were able to put together a relay team against the world's greatest marathoner, you would be able to pace them right out of the race. And that's what the Celtics did. They paced people right out of the game most of the time.
Mm-hmm. It all worked in 1974 with the NBA championship in a tough seven-game series against Milwaukee. And 2 years later, you faced the Phoenix Suns, in which you were heavily favored. The fifth game at Boston Garden is the game that everyone remembers from that series. Three overtimes, incredible swings of emotion, physically and emotionally exhausting, and I know you had a fainting spell after the game due to dehydration. What stands out to you most about that incredible game?
Well, just the fact that we won it, and we thought we won it several times, and because of what happened at one portion of the game, it provoked a rule change. Phoenix gained an advantage by calling a timeout when they were not, they had no timeouts left. And we ended up shooting free throws, but they got possession of the ball, which nobody ever thought about that you could do something like that. And the next year, they changed the rule that you could not gain any kind of advantage if you really called an illegal timeout. So strange things happened in that game. Paul Westphal played great, John Havlicek for us. People fouled out. Both teams needed to go to their bench. And our bench, really, because we used a lot of people to win in this pace-type basketball game, we had people that were perhaps more experienced in pressure situations than Phoenix did.
Yeah, it was. I think Glenn McDonald had a big triple, big effort in the third overtime, if I'm not mistaken. And
right.
Yeah, and Paul Westphal was the one that called that timeout, found the loophole in the rules, and created that basket to cause the third overtime by Garfield Hurd. Now, eventually you moved on to broadcasting, and I said at the top you've been a Celtics broadcaster for more than 30 years. But in that time, you worked nationally for CBS, and for much of that time with the network, the Celtics of Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish were in or competing for the NBA championship. Did you find it tough to remain objective during those national broadcasts that the Celtics were involved in, knowing your relationship with the team?
Well, I was also broadcasting the team's games, so I actually did two different types of broadcasts. I mean, when I did the Celtic games, people really tuned in because they were Celtic fans, and it was a regional network I was working for. To this day, I still do. When I got to CBS, the national broadcast, you were talking to basketball fans, not necessarily Celtic fans. And I approached it differently than I did when I broadcast only the Celtics. I would get scouting reports prior the week before, and then I would go over them like I was a coach, and I would look at each team's ability to attack the weakness of the other team. And it was amazing. They thought I was a real homo when the Los Angeles Lakers fans found out they had a weakness and that you could beat them with these weaknesses. And then when I got to Boston, I did the same thing. And some of the Celtic fans say, what is he doing? They wrote me in a newspaper several times because of what I said in a national broadcast. But I was doing it for the people in El Paso, Texas, really.
I think, weirdly, that shows that you were doing it right when both sides are criticizing you, thinking you're a homer. But knowing your length and breadth of knowledge with regards to the Celtics, so many Hall of Famers, so many retired numbers, is there a particular player that you think is underrated that doesn't get the credit that he deserves?
Tom Sanders is in the Hall of Fame, but he's in the Hall of Fame as a contributor. And he should have been in as a player because he was a starter on a lot of those successful teams. And, you know, it's a funny thing. The true spirit of the Celtics isn't how many points you score, it's your contribution. Mm-hmm. And he was probably the second most important defensive player on the Celtics in that era. And because he didn't have the gaudy offensive numbers, they kind of looked down their nose at him. And the other guy that should be in there, in my opinion, in the Hall of Fame is Paul Silas, mm-hmm. who was second banana on the boards to Dave Cowens and was a fabulous defensive player and one of the smartest players that ever played the game. And he was a big part of the two championship teams that I coached.
Yeah. And lastly, what are your expectations for the Celtics this season coming off a fifth-place finish in the East?
Well, they made some strategic moves. They got Al Horford, and Al is an all-star player to go along with Isaiah Thomas, so that's an improvement. So we got a big guy and a small guy, but we lost a guy that was very important to the continuity of what they did last year, and that's Evan Turner. So somehow or other, from the last 3 or 4 years, of drafting, the Celtics have to find a player who this year takes a step up into another plateau. And we're going to see who that might be.
It'll be fun to watch. Tommy, enjoy this upcoming Celtics season, and thanks so much for your time.
You got it.
Be sure to download and listen to all episodes of Profiles in Sports on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play, as well as most other places you listen to podcasts. You can also follow the show via profilesinsports.com or the Facebook page. And you can also follow yours truly, Brian Wright, on Twitter, @BrianWright86.